This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to the DGP with province writer Dana G.
Hi, welcome to the DGP with me, Dana G. Okay, to celebrate Pride, which is on now in Vancouver, we have a couple of tour de forces on the slate. First up, I'm going to be talking with Canadian pop icon, best-selling author, and LGBT activist Carol Pope. Always one to do her own thing, Pope and her band Rough Trade shocked people with their young lesbian and lust song, High School Confidential. Now, 30 years later, Pope is still going strong and still playing. Her memoir, Anti-Diva, is going to be made into a movie, and she's thinking of adding part two to that story. Also on the episode today is RuPaul, drag race veteran Trixie Mattel. Not your usual drag queen glamour puss, Trixie Mattel is. No, you definitely need to go and look at pictures of Trixie to get a good sense of her. So we'll be talking with her today as well. And also, we'll close out the episode with movie reviews with me and Jim Gordon from CTV. Included in the movie rundowns this week will be Woody Allen's new movie, Irrational Man, and a Jake Gyllenhaal, a smashed-up Jake Gyllenhaal in Southpaw. Okay, so let's get started with my chat with the one and only Carol Pope. You can hear a hostile echo click. I want her so much, I feel sick. The girl can't help it, she really can't help it now. It's like a Alrighty, this is a great day. I've got Carol Pope in for the podcast today now. Carol Pope, I'm sitting here with you. This is so exciting. Full disclosure, we know each other beforehand, so, which is always good, I guess. Is it good? Do you like be interviewed by somebody you know or?
Well, I like you.
Okay, good. We're off to a good start. So we're on Periscope right now. People, if you have some questions, send them in the lovely Carrie Birmingham, and Adam will help us with that. So Carol, let's get going. Right off the top, you're here, we're talking about a new EP you've got. It's a re-release, Music for Lesbians, right?
Yes.
So tell me, why re-releases? What have you done differently?
Mastered it.
The first one wasn't mastered?
No, not really. It was more of an iTunes, Amazon release, and then I just signed with this label, Squirt Gun, and they have a distribution deal with E1.
Great.
So they could get it. You know, because I want it to be in stores.
Right. E1, that's good. You'll get some stuff out there.
Yeah.
What's it like to go back and redo something like this? Are you a person that appreciates getting a chance to do that, or is it a pain in the neck, you know, revisionist history in a way?
I just wanted it to be out there and out in stores. And really, you know, I have a pretend label and I have, you know, I sell it on a website, and I just wanted to get it out to more people. So that's why I did that, did the deal with them. And we're probably going to release some of my solo stuff on vinyl too, hopefully.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's really, that's a cool thing that's come back so strongly and people are getting it and can see artwork again. I mean, because you guys, back Rough Trade days, you had some fantastic artwork too. You had artists working on your covers and that were great.
Oh, yeah, General Idea.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all I would say they're all collectible because two-thirds of General Idea are...
Right.
No longer with us.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Tell me about that, though. Like, going back to vinyl, is that something that excites you, that the idea that you can put a package together, that it's not just this sort of disembodied song that people collect?
Yeah, I mean, I really, you know, digital and downloads just sound like crap to me.
Right.
And you know, vinyl is warm, and I think that people are more into actually having... You know, having a tactile experience, like holding an album and, like, you know, looking at the artwork and looking at all the credits and then playing it. And I guess people have finally realized that vinyl sounds better.
Well, and it also sounds better when it's a singer of your quality and your depth and warmth. I mean, vinyl captures that and there's no faking it, right? And you seem to be like hearing that voice, it belongs, it should be lush. It should be represented as the lushness that it is.
Yeah.
And the answer to that question is just yes.
Correct. Yes. All right. Yes.
But let's talk a little bit about that voice. I mean, so recognizable. I'm wondering if you can take me way back to when you started singing and somebody said to you or looked at you and went, holy shit, the sound of this kid. How did it start?
I used to hang out with a lot of musicians, and I secretly wanted to be, you know, a rock star. And so I'd write music, and, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people kind of encouraged me to keep singing. And then, you know, I started a band with Kevin Staples.
Mm-hmm. Not just a band, but a band.
Well, we had some other bands before Rough Trade.
What were some of the names?
Oh, which was just a trio.
Just O?
Yeah, as in the story of O, because right. I was obsessed with S&M.
Okay.
That was our first band. It was just Kevin and I and a keyboard player. And then we had the Bullwhip Brothers, which was just mm-hmm. Kevin and I. And then finally we went to Rough Trade and got a whole band.
You guys are such an entity. Rough Trade is the look, the style. And I'm going to go back to your unique sound of your voice. Did the way that you sound help dictate what you were going to look like or vice versa? I mean, you have this, you know, balls to your voice. And I know that's a strange thing to say to somebody who's, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely like sexually androgynous, and the music was sexually androgynous and sexual and parodying sexuality. And yeah, I'm like, I'm just going to wear a bondage suit and I'm going to pretend to whip people and I'm going to mock sex. So I guess it all worked with my voice.
Yeah. Looking back, I mean, go back to Rough Trade days and all those big hits, you know, we're a few decades back. You guys were actually saying something, just, you know, dressing up and all that and having an edge, but you were actually saying stuff. Do you look back on that band with, well, how do you look back on that band? What do you think of when you think of Rough Trade?
I think we were both surprised that we got as far as we did. But then because we were innovative, we didn't get far enough. And because I was sexually androgynous, because we were like ahead of the curve, and I think that I was kind of threatening to labels and... So
they didn't know what to do with you, did they?
They didn't know what to do with us, so that was kind of the bummer part. And then, the real bummer was when we were touring with Bowie and we didn't get tour support. I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, that's, you think that would be just like the perfect fit. You should have had all the support in the world for that tour.
Yeah.
Because it's like, hello, perfect opening act for David Bowie. And the content, and then back to that, just because we're in this world now where, you know, the LGBT movement and stuff has moved so fast as an issue. I mean, maybe not fast is the right word, but it's compared to any other social issues. Like, this has really gone steps and bounds forward. I mean, you were talking about this all those years ago, you know, High School Confidential. I think you probably had about, I don't know, how many people have come up for come up to you in the streets over the years and said they've come out to that song.
Yeah.
That song's helped them to come out.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you've heard that probably thousands of times, right?
I've heard it a lot, yes.
And what's your answer to that? When someone says that to you, what's your response?
I don't know. I just say thank you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were really influenced or moved by that. Or even straight people. I mean, it's an anthemic song.
Right.
So even if they didn't know what
it's the high school experience, really,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And did the sales of Tigress by Fabergé go through the roof after that? Did they have a spike?
I don't even think they really made that anymore. I just
thought it was you smell, yeah.
It was the trashiest like scent I could think of.
And it sounds good. It sounds good. But you know, it's interesting that song back then. You're saying all these things and all this talk, and then we go. You know, we roll ahead 30 years, and Katy Perry has a huge hit with "I Kissed a Girl," and everybody's like, "Ooh." And for me, I look at that song and I think she's singing to get men excited about possibly watching hot lesbians make out. Right? It's like, you know, that old.
Right? Absolutely.
So it's just sort of, it seems, it's sort of funny to me that anybody would attach to that song as like, you know, take a powerful thing when you had High School Confidential. My God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything is redundant now.
Yeah.
I think.
Nothing new. You've seen it all?
I don't know. Well, I mean, you know, they're just, I think what I was doing with sexuality was A, parodying it, and then it was kind of titillating, and now it's just like so extreme. It's gone so far that it really, it's not sexy, and you know, it's just people use it for shock value.
Are we still shocked by it, though? That's the part that I don't get.
Well,
who's shocked by this now?
They're redneck people.
I guess so. The Britney Spears fans and stuff like that in the South, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we're not shocked, and kids today are not shocked, and they're definitely gender and sexually fluid, and mm-hmm. they don't have any issues with any of this stuff, but
Yeah, big difference, right? From when you were a kid, right? Nobody talked about this stuff, did they?
Yeah.
They just thought you were weird, right?
Exactly.
Well, you're still weird. Weird is good, though, right? Weird's weird. Better than not being.
Weird is a beautiful thing.
It is, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about that. You carried the mantle of this, of equal rights. I mean, you lost a brother to AIDS. You had that era that, unfortunately, a lot of our great artists were lost to us because nobody did the right thing. And you carried forward and you talked about all sorts of issues and stuff. Do you ever get tired of being the person that everybody wants to look to and wants you to say something all the time about stuff? Or
no, I don't mind it because, you know, somebody's got to do it and there's just so much wrong. I mean, gay rights have certainly evolved, but, you know, people are still having unprotected sex and they think, oh, I'll just take the cocktail. Mm-hmm. What do you want to be on, like, have unprotected sex and be on drugs the rest of your life? And it's insane.
It's insane that you have to still act like somebody's mother and tell people that, right? Like, how? I don't understand that. Does it feel that much better? I don't know. Like, what are they talking about? Why are people not heeding this?
I don't know. I mean, I guess you think when you're young, you know, you're like, oh, it's not going to happen to me. I'm going to live forever. I mean, you know, I remember being that young, but
yeah,
forget about it.
It's not going to not happen to you. It's going to.
Yeah.
Making music now through the years, has that changed the way you approach making a record now? Or do you always sort of have a way that you go in, you get ready, you write? Tell me a little bit about your process. What if there is one?
I don't know if there is one. I mean, yeah, I mean, this, you know, Music for Lesbians is a concept EP. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm just going to write about being lesbian and the highs and lows. I'm going to mock feminism a little bit because feminists have no sense of humor. but...
Do you like that? You like to get into trouble a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I don't know. I just write stuff and a lot of stuff and some of it, and, you know, there's either a concept or there's no concept, and it evolves into an album. And then I like, really nag people that I want to write with. Mm-hmm. I really have to nag them a lot. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm supposed to ask Sebastian Bach wants to record with me.
Wow.
Of all people.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to do that.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
You know what? Usually when you go across so many, or such a wide divide, that the best stuff comes from that, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I think so. I mean, it's just something I would never.
And it's just like Carol Pope and Sebastian Bach. And no, it has a ring to it. There's two names that automatically people think of those two people.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Well, I have to talk to you about this. I mentioned before we started recording because I have lots of musicians in my life. And when whoever mentions you come up, or I've heard the conversation come up, but we'll just cut to it. Direct to disc. Every musician I know that knows about that record is A, blown away that it was made and that it's so great. And I always want to know, I want to know, first of all, did you do the whole thing live through between songs? Did you stop between songs?
No, you can't stop.
You can't stop anything.
The way they recorded in the ye olden days when they used to.
We should tell people, if you don't know about this album, if you can find it, because it's a collector's album, it's pretty tough to find, right?
Yeah.
It's Rough Trade, and it's a whole way through, and you record it on acetate. Is that how it's done first? And then they press the album right there?
Yeah, it was being mastered in another room. We did like 53 takes. Jack Richardson produced it.
The great Jack Richardson, yeah.
But he was in like playing percussion with us. So they would master it in another room and then they'd listen to it and see if it was okay. But yeah, you had to do like 5 or 6 songs perfectly in order to have it mastered.
Boy, you couldn't do that with a lot of bands today, could you?
No. No, Pro Tools people, you could not.
You could not use the Pro Tools. I know it's funny, I have friends that are producers and they're like, why are you coming down to the studio and hang out? I'm like, I'd rather chew glass lots of times because it's so boring. It's like, first of all, the cocaine and the hookers are gone.
Yeah, that's true. That's boring.
That's boring. Everybody's eating cold pressed juice. But it's also just, it's so sterile, the process. It's like one part over and over and over again. So doing something like that, I mean, you must be proud of that, having that as a part of your record, part of your past.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to just play stuff live.
Right.
You know, we did that on here. We did a couple of songs like that.
Right. Music for Lesbians. Now, Carol, how did you come up with that title?
Because I was mocking lesbians. I don't know. And it also kind of sounds like an Eno album.
It does, actually.
And the first song I wrote, co-wrote with Tim Walsh, my guitar player, we were just goofing around doing an acoustic gig, and it kind of happened. Mm-hmm. And then we recorded it, and we sent it to Peaches.
Because
I said, do you want to write a rap? And she's like, this shit is great. Yeah, and so she wrote this really fantastic rap.
Let's go into the forest. and menstruate on a stick. Look, there's a drum circle. Maybe we could join in. Let's go down to the fire pit, roast some tofu dogs. Maybe some dykes in a tent will have some beer. We're lesbians in the forest. Let's go to the S&M tent and learn how to fist fuck. We can do whatever we want, 'cause this is a man-free zone. Except for the guys who empty the chains, we don't call them Johns. Here at the Michigan Women's Festival, we worship the goddess. We're lesbians in the forest.
Everybody with a frightening body walk around naked. Why do women grow facial hair? Why do I have to look at that? No offense to anyone who's transitioning. Oh, fuck! There's my ex!
With her new girlfriend. Buddy, you are so much hotter. You're Ellen's ex, Katie's ex, Alicia's ex, Portia's ex, the Indigo's ex, Jody's ex, my ex, ex's ex. We're lesbians in the forest.
No X key score, this is a forest, same-sex schmorgas, fuck a Greek chorus. I swore this would be a dinosaur weekend. Dyke beacon, hair Mohican. I diddle a woodland fairy, whittle my woody scary. Middle of me is hairy, middle of me is dairy. Nymphs, fairies, witches, not a cock in sight, 'cause sisters are doing themselves all night.
Yeah, lesbians in the forest.
I just see now when you say collaborations or when you say you worked with Peaches, I don't know why, but that just, I'm like, well, of course you did. Like, it just seems like she would be a love child of yours somewhere along the
exactly.
line.
Exactly. I mean, she's like,
she's not afraid.
No. And she was definitely influenced by me, and she's just doing that. She's taking that sexual thing to a whole other level, mm-hmm. you know? But I mean, she's political, but my music is, I would say, more sexual and political right. now.
And I bet you, does she have cops at her shows? I mean, I was going back to some old clips of Rough Trade, and there's police at some of your shows. Because what were they thinking you were going to do? Were you going to rape somebody on stage, or what did they think was going to happen?
They were upset that I was going to grab my crotch or whip people or whatever. So, yeah, they would be there. Really.
I know. Watch out. The singer's going to get you. So we got to talk to you about this interview's airing when we're Vancouver Pride is on here. Now, you've just got finished up at Toronto Pride.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you must be the queen of Pride festivals. I mean, you have been at a million, right?
Yeah. I love doing Prides, and this one was great because Pussy Riot was there.
Mm-hmm. And how was that like? Did you chat with them? You meet them?
I didn't. Somebody who was singing a song with me chatted with them, and mm-hmm. but the English is not really good.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, one of them went up on stage and went, "Down with Putin, death to Putin," you know.
Which is so great, right?
But they were also riding in the parade on top of a missile. They were astride this red missile on this giant tank truck, army truck thing.
Right.
And it was supposed to ejaculate, but it didn't, oh, which was sad.
Oh, that ruins
I
everything.
Know.
So what makes a great pride for you?
It's just such a wonderful audience. Everybody's there to celebrate. You know, it's not just gay, lesbian, bi, transgender, all those initials. It's just a lot of people kind of, I think, celebrating life and sexuality and partying. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very, always sweet and warm and open. And, yeah, it's like, you know, what's not to like?
Yeah, and I guess this year, the most recent one's coming up with Pride has got quite a weight to it with the American Supreme Court ruling and stuff, and there's, you know, another big step forward. Do you ever want to get married?
Gay married? Let me think. I don't know. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of marriage, but maybe if I met the right, you know, I have never been with anybody more than 4 years, so I don't know. But maybe.
Not even Dusty? Would Dusty have been marrying material?
No.
No? I remember you told me a story years ago when we first met, though, and it always, when your name comes up, since you wrote the book Anti-Diva in 2000, where you first talked about the relationship you had with the great Dusty Springfield, I remember you saying to me one time that there was nothing greater than waking up in the morning and you're hearing Dusty Springfield singing in the shower, hearing that voice.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that must have been just amazing. Tell me a little bit about your time with her. She's such an incredible talent.
You know, she had a lot of issues. she had some drinking issues and things. But I just used to just go, tell me, you know, what was it like to tour with so-and-so? And tell me about the food fights. And, you know, she worked at the Apollo. She worked with Gene Pitney.
Wow.
She had her own TV show. She had the Beatles on. She had Jimi Hendrix on. She jammed with all these people. And before that, she was in... I didn't even realize that she was... in a trio called the Lana Sisters before she was in the Springfields with her brother.
Right.
And then she went solo.
Mm-hmm.
She was just kind of a font of information about those, the ye old days.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of, for someone who loves music, it's a living encyclopedia for you, I guess.
Yeah.
And a reference point, when someone can actually reference those people as they're knowing them.
I
know.
It cuts
out all the bullshit, doesn't it? You get it real.
I remember being in L.A. with her, and she was driving around, and she's, because she and Dionne Warwick were like little rivals, and she'd go, look at this. She'd drive me to her house and go, this is really ugly. And then she drove me to Phil Spector's house, and she said, he's sitting there with some dogs and some guns.
he's sitting in there with some dogs. And she's quite prescient on that fact, wasn't she?
Yeah.
What did you learn from her as an artist or as a performer?
Well, she was a real perfectionist, so I don't know. I was like flattered that she, you know, liked my singing and my writing, and she recorded a couple of songs that we wrote, softcore, and I'm curious, and she sang on one of our albums, actually with my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be more poignant?
Yeah.
On a track called "Sacred and the Profane."
Mm-hmm.
She was just a real pro, you know, with like a 100 million other issues that we won't go into.
Well, that's life, right?
Yeah.
I think if we went through, well, all of us, we'd have some. Let's talk a little bit now. Anti-Diva came out in 2000 and was a big success. Everybody loved that book. And I remember when the book came out thinking, I can't believe she hasn't done one already. So tell me about the process to decide at that point in life that you're going to sit down and do your memoir and pick what you're going to talk about.
I had an editor. At first, I just wanted to do essays, and she's like, no, you have to write an autobiography. You have to write about your childhood and all this. It's like, all right. So Anti-Diva was what came out of all that, and I optioned the film rights, 2006, and now it's in pre-production.
Oh, okay. Well, that's on my list. So tell me about that. So pre-production, when are they going to start shooting? Tell us about
either
it.
It's going to be, they're just starting, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this stuff, but I'm saying it anyway.
I'm sure you've always followed the rules, Carol Pope, so stick right to them.
They are just casting.
Cool.
And it's going to either shoot in the fall or the spring.
And is it being shot in Canada or where?
Yeah, but it's got, you know, other involvement.
They haven't cast you yet, the present day?
Somebody has signed a letter of intent, but I can't tell you who.
And are you happy about that?
Yeah.
Who it is? I'm just sitting here looking at you thinking, oh my God, who is it? Who is it? Who is it?
I
know you'd be a good one for a strong actor to get their hands on, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a really good part you know, I mean, there's like some really strong female leads because it's really me and my mother. Whoever plays my mother, mm-hmm. that's a good mm-hmm. part. Because yeah. my mother was very eccentric and mm-hmm. fabulous.
I don't know. Yeah, I wonder where you get it from then.
I don't know.
You don't know. So was it hard for you, though, to sit down and put all that stuff together? Were you, are you one that was ever sort of self-reflective before, or was it always just it came out in a song? Or
I don't know if I was that reflective, and I don't like to dwell on the past, and mm-hmm. but it was like purging myself, and it was just a big stream of consciousness, and then the editor was like, you know, help me put it in some kind of order. Mm-hmm. But I do like writing, but I'm such a perfectionist. It's like, oh, it takes me so long to something done.
Right, right. What are you working on right now? What are you doing?
We're just at the very beginning of trying to write a musical.
Oh.
Based on some rough trade music and a lot of my solo stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with two people in New York, mm-hmm. Kate Rigg. Mm-hmm. Who's a very talented writer, actress, performer. She has a band called Slanty Eyed Mama. Mm-hmm. and Rob Pruse, who used to be in the Spoons and is kind of the music director of Mamma Mia, but he's worked on a lot of other Broadway shows.
So it sounds like that you keep opening doors to different types of creativity over in the last few years. Is that what keeps you happy? Is it could, you know, because you don't really want to be a tribute act, right? I mean, because you're such a character, you're such a shape, you're a package, you're Carol Pope walking down the street, mm-hmm. right? Anybody that's been, you know, is 40 will know Carol Pope walking down the street.
Yeah.
So is the tendency to always try to find a different avenue just to stop from maybe becoming just that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'll do that. I'll do rough trade that stuff for money, but it's, you know,
I'll do rough trade for money. We'll just cut that clip out. And
yeah, I'll do it for the money. Yeah. But no, I mean, everybody, artists want to do different mm-hmm. things, and I want to grow as an artist, mm-hmm. and I want to try things I haven't tried, because otherwise, why do it?
Right.
I don't want to be like a tribute band, babe. No. A tribute to myself.
A tribute to yourself. That's kind of funny. Come out, pretend to be Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm not Carol.
I'm not Carol. I just look a lot like her. Yeah. A lot like her. What's fun for you right now? What do you do for fun? When you're not doing this stuff, you're not performing, where are you? What are you doing?
I like to travel. I'm in LA right now. I don't know how long that's going to last. I like to hike. I like to go to the desert. Mm-hmm. I love film, but there's not that much great film. Mm-hmm. But there are more parts for women. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see that movie, that new Todd Haynes movie, called Carol.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of good little ones. We'll talk about them later that I'll point you to that are quite great that are out. So you're back in L.A. I know that that's not one of your favorite places, is it?
It's not my favorite place, but I got a really good house.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, New York I was living in. In the East Village, and it's just getting all gentrified and mm-hmm. full of Euro trash, and it's so expensive, and they're tearing everything good down, you know, all the funky shit is going.
Yeah. What do you think about what's going on in the world right now? You're in the States, that's an interesting place to be. You've got all these, everybody's talking about elections, you've got Donald Trump, but you know, he's, ugh. I know, well, you lived in New York for a long time, do you find it hard that he's polling so high, I find it hard that anybody would take this guy
he's
seriously?
He's polling high?
Yeah, he really is. He's like number two in the Republicans right now.
Behind Jeb, the frightening Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
Well, people are idiots. Republicans, I don't know what happened to them. You know, Lincoln was a Republican. I don't know what went wrong.
Yeah.
It's just something went really horribly wrong, and they've been co-opted by the Koch brothers and bunch of rednecks, bunch of yellowhammers.
Yellowhammers, yeah. It's a tough place to like right now, isn't it, America? You look at it and you just think, why didn't you fix anything?
Yeah, but things are getting done. But I've only lived in New York State and California. Mm. I don't think I could live anywhere else because I'd want to kill everybody.
Yeah.
And they'd want to kill me.
You see, yeah, I don't know. Once they got to know you, though, it'd be fine.
Well, I don't want to live in the middle. Middle red states.
You don't live back here at all in Canada? You're in the States all the time now?
Yeah. No, yeah. I've lived in America since 1989. Wow. I mean, it is kind of crazy. It is. Everybody's going, what the, you know, what the hell?
No water in California. How's that affecting your life?
I've always conserved water because I've lived there a couple of times before. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to rat people out if I see them watering their lawns. But they're trying to get rid of all the lawns.
Right.
And, but, you know, like that company Nestle is like bottling water from California. I mean, there's just so much corruption going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have Nestle issues here, too. And I hope that they went in and took a whole bunch of water.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just boycotting them and all their products. And I didn't even realize how many different bottled waters they manufacture.
It's hard. Life's hard right now to keep up with all this stuff.
I know, but you got to be on it. I mean, you don't want to support all that.
No.
All the slime
balls.
No,
I'm pretty good at that stuff. I am. I try to be. So we're moving forward. You're going to have a movie. Like, that's so exciting. Mm-hmm. And it must be nerve-wracking, too, though, right? You worry how it's going to... Especially if you're a fan of good film, you know what a bad film can be.
I know. Yeah, it is nerve-wracking, but, you know.
Did you see the Brian Wilson movie?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
That's good. It's good. What I really liked about it is that it reminds people or educates people that the Wrecking Crew was, you know, Glenn Campbell and great studio musicians were the band. Because that's what it really focuses on. And it does a lot to give those guys reverence to say, you know, his vision was brought to life by these great studio musicians. So...
Exactly. I mean, even the Beatles used other musicians too.
Yeah. Is that a great thing about still wanting to record? Is getting to go in and find people to play with?
Yeah. I mean, I always bug people that I like. You know, like, will you write with me? Because I co-wrote something with Hoxley Workman. Mm-hmm. I worked with this other guy, Alan Johannes, who was in Queens of the Stone Age and them Crooked Vultures and had a band called Eleven. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just worship him and I want to do more with him. But it was also great. Hoxley is brilliant, brilliant.
I could see you and Hoxley Workman getting along because his flair for the theatrical as well and the bigger sound and the... And he strikes me as someone, too, that is kind of what you do, has their hands in all sorts of different creative outlets in order to...
Yeah, and I just saw his band, the Mounties, played at Pride, and they're amazing. Yeah. And he was just drumming, and he's just so multi-talented.
Mm. Cool. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Do you have any questions?
Do I have any questions? It's a podcast. Why is it so hot here? What's going on?
I think it's called climate change.
Oh.
I think so. I've heard tell... I know it's usually not hot here this time of year. I know my 13-year-old Jack Russell Terrier has got one position through this weather, flat out on the floor.
Yeah, it's
panting
crazy.
Like his heart's going to explode.
It's really crazy. How long has this drought been going on? Or
it's been hot here, I guess, for a couple weeks now, hasn't it? Yeah. All right. Well, we're good to go. You and I will get caught up even further later.
All right.
Thanks for coming in, everybody. That was Carol Pope. Get her new EP, Carol Pope, Music for Lesbians. And you don't just have to be a lesbian to enjoy it, though.
No, exactly. It's not just for lesbians.
It's not just for lesbians. But if you're thinking about becoming a lesbian, that's okay. We're still podcasting. If you're thinking about becoming a lesbian, that's a perfect gift for somebody.
Oh, yeah, right.
For your lesbian gift basket.
Yeah.
It's perfect. Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Carol.
You're welcome. Some velvet morning when I'm straight. I'm gonna open up your gate. Maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it end. Some velvet morning when I'm straight. Flowers growing on a hill, dragonflies, daffodils, bloom for us very much. Look at us, but do not touch. Phaedra is my some velvet morning when I'm straight. I'm gonna open up your gate. And baby, tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it end. Some velvet morning when I'm straight.
I'm gonna open up your gates.
Dragonflies, daffodils,
and maybe tell you about Phaedra.
Learn from us very much,
and how she gave me life.
Look at us, but do not touch,
and how she made.
Okay, so that was my chat with the legendary Carol Pope. Don't forget to check out her new album, Music for Lesbians. Straight to the Point is the title of that, and is Carol. It's a EP. We've enjoyed it here at the DGP, haven't we, Adam?
Yes, we have.
Yes, we have. Next up, because it's Pride, and we've obviously got a bit of a theme going here, I'm going to be chatting with Trixie Mattel. A bundle of dark cartoon energy, I guess you could say, is Trixie Mattel. Before we get into the conversation with her, I just want to give you a heads up that Trixie will be part of the Queen of the Night show, August 1st at the Commodore. It's part of Pride. It's a big, colorful drag queen review, so go check that out. It's always a ton of fun. So in the meantime, we caught up with Trixie Mattel at her home in Milwaukee. Alrighty, so on the line with me now is the lovely, gorgeous, I should say gorgeous, Trixie Mattel. You're in, where did you say you are? You're in Milwaukee, right?
Oh my gosh, gorgeous. Have you seen any pictures of me? It's okay. It might look beautiful if you have like a glass eye and the glass eye also have glaucoma. You know, then I look really good. And in Milwaukee.
I'm not, you know what? I think that it's a state of mind. And I think that the work and the effort that you put into that look makes you gorgeous. And you're from Laverne and Shirley land, right?
Oh yeah, totally. Oh yeah, it is here, isn't it? Yeah. Because they worked at a beer bottling factory, didn't they?
They did indeed.
I knew this.
Indeed.
If you're ever in Milwaukee and you go downtown, Happy Days also happen here. And we have a huge bronze statue of the Fonz giving two thumbs up.
That is the greatest thing. I loved the Fonz when I was a kid. That was my drag. I think I dressed up as the Fonz like five Halloweens in a row.
Yeah, in Wisconsin, we don't worry about, you know, any actually like American heroes or anything. We, you know, focus on TV shows that we've been featured in. You know, it's funny, being from Milwaukee, too. If you ever saw the movie Bridesmaids, whenever I tell people I'm from Milwaukee, they're like, oh, you're from Milwaukee? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, thank you.
That's hilarious. Well, tell me, born and raised in Milwaukee, how did you become Trixie Mattel? Where did this come from?
Well, I had a group interview at a Forever 21, and I never got a call back, and it's my only other option. No, I'm just kidding. Well, I was in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I had to fill in last minute for somebody who did drag. So I just kind of got thrown into it. And then I did it once as like a last minute kind of thrown in thing, and then I liked it, and I kept doing it. And then it started as just like a weird random thing into a hobby, into, you know, a part-time job, into a career. So, you know, enough makeup, you can fool people into paying you. That's what I found.
Now, Trixie, you're coming to Vancouver to be part of Pride festivities here. You're going to be performing in the Queen of the Night show. Is Pride like the busiest, you know, this time of year, this season, summer season, the busiest time of year for drag queens?
Can I share? I feel like I know you, so can I share this with you?
You can tell me anything.
Like, Trixie, how's Pride going? And I say, it's great, but like my inside is screaming, I've been in drag for 3 days in the sun, and I wish I was dead. No, like, it's not that I'm not grateful for Pride season, but when you're in drag, you know, it's like you're pinched and cinched and taped, and you're so uncomfortable, but you want to bring the fantasy even in the broad daylight, so you just do it.
Yeah, you don't.
A lot of us have to do night gigs, and then the next day we're on parades. Or, like, I was in Toronto, like, last week, and I had to be on the Breakfast Television Toronto at, like, 8 a.m., and then I had a show that night, and it was just like, ugh, to get into like twice in one day, it's not right. This is not right.
Well, yeah. How long does it take you to get the full meal deal?
It takes about 2 hours.
Yeah.
It takes us about 1 hour 10, and then 50 minutes to get into the body and the corset and the hair and the nails and the costume and everything.
Yeah, that's not something you want to have to do a lot. Like twice a day, that would make me crazy. That would make you a very sad-looking Trixie, I would imagine.
That's why I paint my paint so extremely, so that like people don't see that my face is just, you know, just a permanent grimace, you know, from pain.
Okay. Well, everybody that fans or that are going to be listening here are going to be fans of RuPaul's Drag Race and saw you in action there. You're season 7. Did you watch the show from the very beginning before or and ever have an idea that you would love to be on there or ever have a chance of being on that show?
Well, I had that experience in Rocky where I had to be thrown into drag like last minute. And then after doing it for a little bit, then I discovered Drag Race. I watched the first few seasons like without knowing that they existed prior to that. And then I kind of watched it as I was always doing drag. You know, it's like for us, it's our Olympics. For drag queens, it's our, you know, it's our Super Bowl every week. So we're watching that. And then I would have always wanted to do it, but I never thought I could do it because I thought it was too strange. And then in season 6, they had some queens who were possibly even stranger than me. So I was like, it felt like good timing. And RuPaul always talks about windows opening and closing and being sensitive to like the energy. And I just kind of felt like if I audition this year, I will make it. And they did.
Now, is he that pretty in real life? Is he?
Oh, better.
Yeah?
Totally better. I feel like drag queens go one of two ways in real life. Either they look so much worse in real life or so much more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And RuPaul looks even more beautiful. I mean, even when we're filming the reunion, I was maybe sitting like 2 feet from her and she still looked exactly like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The other thing, you know, this is a weird thing to say about a show about drag queens, but what I liked about it was just his suits, his clothes, his not in drag clothes. It just looked amazing.
Oh, yeah. In season 5 of Drag Race, there was a queen named Coco Montrese, and she said that RuPaul dresses like the Black Pee Wee Herman, which I think is pretty spot on.
But see, yeah, I was really attracted to his suits, and I'm not even a lesbian. I just thought that they were just so natty. Yeah, he always looks great.
Oh, it's so much fantasy. It's like full fitted Technicolor, like only RuPaul could pull it off.
I know.
You know what I mean?
So you tour a lot. You're out. How much luggage do you take with you?
Oh my God! Some queens are really lucky. You know, they pack like a swimsuit and a ponytail, and they're good to go. Mia Trixie Mattel. I mean, I carry tons of merchandise, puppets, giant wigs, big costumes. You know, so I'm usually looking at 3 to 4 suitcases that I carry around by myself. Plus a backpack and a fanny pack.
You've got a fanny pack?
Yeah, I'm a fanny pack. I'm known for my fanny pack. Here's the thing. I'm from Wisconsin, so most people are like, oh, you're wearing a fanny pack. Very retro. You're bringing it back. I'm like, oh, no. I'm from the Midwest. It's always been there.
It's never going anywhere.
So,
where did the actual persona of Trixie Mattel come from? How did you decide on this?
Well, I always wanted, when I was little, I was somewhat oppressed. I mean, I wasn't allowed to show a lot of emotion or act very feminine. And when I did, I was called a Trixie. And I also was always wanted, you know, like My Little Ponies and Polly Pocket and Barbie, and I was never allowed to have those things. So as an adult, I have this kind of off-color sense of humor, and I kind of combined that with the imagery that I was so attracted to as a child, and I got this kind of winning combination that people kind of respond to, surprisingly. So it's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great that you seem to have a lot of fun with the character. Like you're not just trying to be a gorgeous woman. You're trying to be an interesting woman.
I mean, there are birthday clowns out there who are less dressed up than me. Do you know what I mean? So I just go for it because I just believe in drag 100% or 0%. And I believe you can go to the mall and see a beautiful woman any day of the week, so why would you want to look like a real person? I like to look like a sock puppet.
Sock puppet.
I like to look like I came from Fraggle Rock.
You're pretty hot for a sock puppet. I was just looking. You're actually recently you're going from Mobile, Alabama to São Paulo, Brazil in a matter of days.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like quite a wild trip.
Yeah. Oh, do you know how much it costs to go to South America, by the way?
I have no idea.
It costs about $1 Brazilian.
Did I really fall for that? Shit.
It was good, right?
Oh my God. You. Tip your waitress. You did. You sucked me right in on that. So what does the future hold for Ms. Trixie Mattel?
Well, right now I'm kind of, I'm looking at a whole year ahead of me of touring and traveling. And part of touring and traveling is experimenting with new material. And I'm developing a kind of a one-woman show. One man show, one human show, I guess.
Right.
One stock puppet show. It's going to be called Trixie Mattel Ages 3 and Up, and it's going to be one of the first highly interactive and audience participation comedy shows. So it's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. And it's pretty far out. I'm still working on it, but I'm working on that. And I'm traveling. I mean, I'm lucky enough. I'm pretty much going to every corner of the planet. I mean, I'm going to Europe a few more times. I'm doing, you know, Brazil. I'm doing Canada a whole bunch more times. I love Canada. I love you guys.
Well, we're kind of similar, aren't we? Where you're from, your neck of the woods,
well,
I guess.
What I feel in Canada, well, number one, everyone talks really cute. And number two, it feels just like the United States, except people are genuinely friendlier. I mean,
right. Truly.
I was in a mall, and I was in a food court, and my computer was dying. And not only was it dying, I could not get the Wi-Fi to work, and I was just frustrated. And somebody next to me was like, had a wireless Wi-Fi thing, and was like, "You can just hook up to mine if you want and borrow Wi-Fi. It's no problem." And I was just like, "This would literally never happen in America, ever, ever, ever."
Right. What do you look like? I know this sounds like I'm just trying to figure a way to phrase this without insulting you. What do you look like when you're out just wandering around?
Oh, garbage. Literally garbage. I'm the worst dressed human on earth. Today I was wearing like moccasins with socks, cut off sweatpants, a dirty t-shirt with a makeup ring all the way around my neck, my signature fanny pack, dirty nails. I need a haircut so bad. It's so bad.
Oh.
It's just bad. Yeah, I'm very driven. I think that's the reason drag works for me, because essentially it's a small business, and every day I get to wake up and go find my own success. So it's amazing. I love it. I love everything about it.
Well, so when you come here to do the show for our Pride festivities, what can people expect? If they didn't know you from Drag Race and not seen Trixie Mattel before, what can you give them a heads up?
Yeah, I'm going to be bringing some great stuff. I'm going to be bringing some puppets. I'm a dancer, so there's a lot of dance involved too. And I like to grab the microphone after my numbers and play with the audience a lot. So it's very interactive. And my lip syncs are very, they're more mashup style. So it's songs mixed with clips, mixed with dialogue, for comedy. So it's great. And, you'll be able to see my makeup from even the farthest away from the stage.
How much makeup do you go through, like, say, in a month? What's your makeup budget?
Some things I have a lot of. Some things like black and white eyeshadow, for example, I run through white eyeshadow like you wouldn't believe, because I use it on so many things in my face.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? Oh, black eyeliner. If you look at my makeup, I use so much gel eyeliner with a little brush. I probably go through a pot a month, and a pot's probably supposed to last people like 6 months.
Right. You've got some. You've got some pretty shocking faces, I have to admit. These are scrolling.
Yeah, even out of drag, my face is shocking.
I don't think so. I saw a picture of you out of drag. Like I said, you look like a freshly scrubbed freshman. So it's a good time. How long is a drag queen's career? What's your shelf life?
Well, it depends who you are, I think. I don't know. I always feel like I'm very lucky because my look is so heavy and put on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm 50 years old doing Trixie Mattel, I don't think I'll really look very different, because my makeup and my look doesn't live on or require any of my natural features. You know, I don't even use my new Reveal eye color. So I think like in 10 years, I'm going to look exactly the same in drag. But some queens who really rely on, you know, like their youth and beauty, you know, they're going to be, you know, working at a Time Warner cable yelling at people on the phone, you know?
Before I let you go, you've had all the success, you know, on the big show. People know who you are. If somebody wanting to start to be a drag queen or to head down this path, what kind of advice can you give them?
Don't do it. Stay in school. No. Well, I'll say this. The only way drag is ever going to work for you is if you are like 3,000% an original. You know, I think in drag world, it's really typical that you have someone teach you how to do drag. For me, I taught everything in drag to myself, and I think that's why, even if you hate me, you've never seen anything like me. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
If you're a small business, you have to be an original. That's the biggest thing.
Right.
If you're doing drag just to do drag, you know, just to be like the kitsch of drag, you're never really going to find your own light and your own little boat to live in, you know?
Can you spot a drag queen out of drag from like a mile away? Do you know if someone's got that in them?
It depends. Like, if you're somebody like me out of drag is like full-on witness protection program. You can't even tell I'm the same person. But some drag queens kind of look more like their real selves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes drag queens have those telltale signs of, like, off-duty drag queen. Like, maybe the guy doesn't have any eyebrows, or they have a full set of nails, or, you know, they're wearing a fanny pack.
Are they wearing a fanny? I love that off-duty drag queen tells. Keep that in mind. I'm going to keep my eyes open for
that.
The eyebrowless.
I strive to not look that. I like to look totally different. I like to look somewhat normal out of drag. But a lot of drag queens, you know, they sacrifice things like their eyebrows, or they, you know, shave their arms and they have like little arm stubbles. Weird little signs like that you can see.
And I think the fanny pack's a good cover for you.
Yeah, people look at me and they're like, well, that can't be Trixie because that's drag queen. And a drag queen with any kind of self-respect or personal style wouldn't be wearing a fanny pack, but that's me.
Attaboy.
No self-respect, no personal style.
Thanks a lot for chatting today.
Bye.
I hear Abe Lucas is going to be joining the faculty this summer.
Really? That should put some Viagra into the philosophy department.
Professor Lucas, welcome to Braylon.
Thank you.
It's so good to have you here.
Your paper was quite good.
Am I blushing right now? He's very radical, very original. You either love him or hate him, really. When I heard you were coming here, I had fantasies that you'd meet something special.
I haven't been able to perform in nearly a year. I can't write. I can't breathe. I couldn't remember the reason for living. And when I did, it wasn't convincing.
Well, if you can't tell by the soft sort of trad jazz music in that clip or the speech patterns that Woody Allen's back, and he's back with a new film called Irrational Man. I'm here with Jim Gordon from CTV, and we are going to review some new movies for you right now. So let's start with Woody. He's back.
Mm-hmm.
The classic thing about Woody Allen, anybody that sees movies for a living, we know, is Woody Allen's one good one, then one bad one good one usually, right?
He's had two bad ones, yeah. It's been two bad ones, but that's been his pattern since he left New York a decade ago.
Yeah, what was the one last year that was so stinky?
Oh, Magic in the Moonlight.
Oh, jeez Louise.
Putting Colin Firth and Emma Stone together as a love interest, and then he had that awful From Rome with Love.
Yeah, you didn't dig that one.
Dreadful.
Yeah, but then he gave us Blue Jasmine.
Blue Jasmine and Midnight in Paris, yeah. Two solid films.
So there you go, right? Yeah. So this is Irrational Man that stars Joaquin Phoenix as a philosophy author, expert, what do you want, teacher, everything. And he goes to this small, snooty college for their summer program, as you do, for the rich young women to go to keep them busy and get their grades up, I guess. He's a bit of a Lothario. He's a big hit. He's got a reputation. He's got everything going on. But he's not come clean about the fact that he's struggling quite a bit at the beginning of this film.
Yeah, he seems to be. I mean, his reputation arrives about a week before he does both the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. And what I love is he's an aging Lothario, but he put on probably, you and I figured, like 25 pounds.
He's to got play a big role. Belly.
Yeah, but he's just burnt out. He's boozing all the time.
His trying to write.
His outlook is bleak, and he's got writer's block.
And he's he hooks up with another faculty member played by the wonderful Parker Posey.
Fabulous.
So great to see her in such a big role too, because I love her. I think she's one of the greats. Emma Stone, you know, Woody Allen likes to go back to young actresses.
She's got his muses, doesn't he?
Well, we had
Scarlett Johansson a decade ago.
Diane Keaton. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them over the years, and now it's Emma Stone, and she plays the young student who falls for the philosophy instructor, and he falls for her. It's an existential adventure, as is almost all Woody Allen movies, right?
Yeah.
When are they not? When is it never about the human condition? Let's just come out and maybe do a disaster film once or a heist movie. Oh, no, he's done heist movies.
He has done heist movies, back in his struggling late 90s days. Yeah.
Struggling late 90s. So what did you think of this one?
I enjoyed this movie. It went in a lot of different directions. I love the fact that he takes his time, and I mean that in a good way, to kind of set the stage. This almost was too much time, but he takes his time to introduce us to all these funny and interesting characters and then lets them slowly come together. Like Parker Posey, you're right. I love her. I wish she could get in. I know she does the occasional big movie, which probably helps the bank account, but she's just so good playing a couple of types of roles, this being one of them, kind of the boozy, very flirty faculty member that immediately wants to sleep with him.
Yeah, immediately, because her husband's a drag.
Yeah.
But there's no fresh ground in this one. So if you're looking for fresh ground, this isn't it. But if you're looking for kind of a sharp, well-written crime and punishment story, because that is essentially what happens.
Well, they mentioned that to Dostoevsky in the movie, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of mention of the Russians.
Yeah.
But I thought I was happy with it. If you just have to slow yourself down. And the interesting release this time of year where all the movies are just smash, crash, bang, boom, coming at you at high speed. This is one, you know, this one I picture of the retired social workers sect, the women gonna go and, you know what I mean? Like, I kind of think that's put out for that, because it's definitely an antidote to the cartoon movies that we're stuck with in the summer.
Yeah, I love the fact that they were releasing a movie like this at this time of the year. Mm-hmm. They did it a couple years ago, Blue Jasmine, and because you just need a break. With Woody Allen movies, I always get the same question from his fans, which is, please tell me this one's good. Yeah, and I've been telling people, yeah, it's not Magic in the Moonlight, because our expectations are always so high. Mm-hmm. Magic in the Moonlight was such a train wreck.
Oh, my God. That was one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Yeah,
I was,
yeah.
I thought halfway through that movie, I thought, is this a joke?
Yeah. is he pulling one over on us? It was so dreadful.
Has Woody's cheese finally slipped off his cracker?
Yeah.
Because he's got to be mid-80s now, isn't he, Woody Allen?
It's early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. But this is not a great Woody Allen movie. I wouldn't put it up there with Blue Jasmine or Midnight in Paris.
No.
But it's a return to fairly good form for him.
Fairly good form. The writing's sharp, yeah. So we're saying, go see
seven and change out of 10 for me.
Seven and change, yeah. Pretty high. Wow.
I'd say seven.
Okay, seven, All right. I can't haggle you up or down from that.
What, are we in a market right now?
We're in a market. We're in a movie opinion market. Please line up, take a number. Okay, our next clip Adam's going to play you, is from the new cartoony, I guess it's half cartoon, half human. What do you want to call it?
A lot of CGI.
Yeah, put it that way. So shot here in Vancouver too. Pixels. Let's have a listen to that.
In 1982, NASA launched a time capsule into space containing examples of our life and culture in hopes of contacting extraterrestrial life. Unfortunately, the message was taken the wrong way.
I believe that some alien life force sent down real-life video games to attack us.
That makes sense.
Okay, that was Adam Sandler and company in Pixels, which is a new, I guess, it's half live action, half a CGI animated. So would you call that animated, I guess?
There's some animated, mostly CGI.
It's a story of a group of friends and one nemesis who were all hotshot video arcade games players in the 80s. So, of course, big shout out to Vancouver band Loverboy, Cha-Ching, working for The Weeknd, played quite a big chunk in that.
Yeah.
I'd like to have the royalties just for that song.
Just for that one song.
And Thunderstruck from AC/DC.
Yeah.
I know. I'd be like the Hugh Grant character.
Or just give me Taking Care of Business from Randy BTO, yeah. Randy Bachman. Yeah. Anyway.
We need to resurrect our songwriting career. Yeah. Anyways, Pixels, so they're in the 80s. You see them as kids. They're all really great players of like Donkey Kong. I never can remember the names of these games.
I never played them back then.
I actually went outside. Super Mario. What's the one with the chomping?
Pac-Man.
The one with the chomping.
Yeah, this is just the first stage after Pong, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So what happens is one of the kids grows up to be the president, played by Kevin James. There's nobody tells you how he ended up as the president, which is quite fascinating because he's an idiot as the president.
Yeah.
Poor Kevin James. I wonder if anybody ever gives him a script that says that, you know, you're not the idiot.
I'd like to see him try to. I mean, he'll never get offered this, but I'd be curious to see what he could do with something serious. If he took a supporting part in a serious director's movie. You know, you got four or five scenes. Come on and try that.
He'd have to change the way he looks. So they flash forward. We're in modern day time, and for some weird reason, through some sort of space and time continuum wormhole.
Because they mail out the time capsule.
Yeah, they mail out a time capsule and they get caught in some space time continuum or a wormhole. There might be string theory.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. There's something going on that I never ponder because it's just too much to think about.
It's a Sandler movie.
The Earth starts to get attacked by characters out of these games. They come down in larger versions of themselves and pixelate.
Yeah.
Everything, and they need a smart scientist to help them fix that, and that just happens to be the beautiful woman role played by Michelle Monaghan, who is a lieutenant colonel in the American military, who's also a science expert.
Yeah,
science expert.
Yeah, science expert.
I'm so clever. So, yeah, what did we think of this, Jim?
You and I discussed this after the film. I'm confused by a couple of things. I can't hate this movie. The kids may like it, but I can't figure out who they're targeting because there's not enough there for the average intelligent adult. I don't know whether the kids...
Is it hipsters? Are hipsters to smoke some weed and go to it? Because those are the games that people
maybe
play. And they're the ones, I think, that have brought back this stuff in their sort of ironic fashion.
So what, kids around mid-20s?
Yeah, because little kids, little kids, 12-year-old boys, do they even bother with this old school stuff? I don't think so. When you can kill hookers in the street and drive a Maserati in a video game, why?
I said this to you earlier that I'm trying to think, would the film equivalent, say, for us be, okay, you're going to sit down and watch a black and white silent 4-minute short from 1885. The beginning. No, except
speak because, for yourself.
No, because I'm only saying is that the kids must look at these games like Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and go, this is like silent movies to us.
Yeah, I don't think this is a kids movie. I don't think the characters are. You know, there's Adam Sandler's hitting on that one character all the time. Peter Dinklage, we should say, is in this.
Tyrion from Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Yeah, he's a mean spirited.
Yeah, he's just not a nice
mullet
character.
Wearing yeah. game playing cheat. So yeah, so there's not. I don't think this is. Yeah, don't take your kids to this one.
Although there were a lot of kids there last night at the screening, and they were quiet, which is I don't think it's for kids. But again, it's just so simplistic and childlike.
That, I don't know. It's hard to tell what people think is right or wrong. A friend of mine just told me they were in California and they went to see Ted at the movie theater, and people were there with like their 4, 5, 6-year-old kids, like. Hello, social services.
Yeah.
Right? How do you explain that movie?
I would have the social services outside the theater as the parents are coming. You're taking a 5-year-old to Ted, too? Anyway, for me, this is a 5 out of 10.
Yeah, I think you're being generous. I was bored out of my skull, and I just thought everybody there was mailing it in. So, yeah.
Sandler has got to pick it up a bit. Yeah.
He needs a clever, so he needs a Judd Apatow movie. He needs to call up his buddy Judd Apatow and get him to write something
for him. But you know what's funny? Just before we move on, every time he does do something like that, no one sees the movies. Like when he did that movie Funny People with Judd Apatow, I thought it was a good movie. It was 19 hours long, but no one goes to see that. And so the studio that he's been with a long time says, get back to this.
Well, the thing is, I think it's because he's wet the bed a few times, right? People are like, oh, why would I see an Adam Sandler movie? I don't care what it is. So he needs to do an uncredited show up in the back of a Woody Allen film or somewhere, or be a really good villain somewhere. Yeah, yeah. And then we'll start talking about him and say, yeah, you know what? Great. Because you know what? He's a star, right?
Yeah.
When he's on. I mean, what was he called? Happy Gilmore?
Yeah.
That was funny.
Wedding Singer,
yeah.
It's great in Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah, yeah. No, he just needs to be interested in it again. But who am I going to tell him? He's sitting at home counting his money.
Yeah.
Okay, the last movie we're going to review for you today, we'll just play a quick clip from, this is Southpaw, the new Jake Gyllenhaal film.
This court is aware of the tragedy your family has suffered, Mr. Hope. Nonetheless, you have chosen to demonstrate dangerous behaviors while having custody of your daughter.
Dad?
You need help, Billy. It'll be a year before your suspension is up, which means zero income.
Legal custody of the child shall remain with family services until the father can demonstrate the abilities of a responsible parent.
Please, please, I don't
care. I'm sorry, please.
Billy, Dad, come on. I'm gonna stay with you. I want to live with you.
Okay, that was Jake Gyllenhaal, Southpaw, Antoine Fuqua directed film, He of Training Day. I'm just going to say off the bat, I, unlike most of the world, didn't lose my mind over Training Day. I thought it was a cartoon most of the time. I thought Denzel winning the Academy Award for that after all the other ones he was passed up for, I thought was a bit weird.
Agreed.
This is Jake Gyllenhaal, right off the top, I'm going to say, is easily one of the best actors working today. I mean, in Nightcrawler last year, or was it called Nightcrawler?
Yeah, Nightcrawler, yeah.
He was unbelievable, and he should have been nominated for every single award for that. This one, he's unbelievable too. The boxing sequences in this, well, I should tell you the story. He's a junior middleweight boxing champion. A terrible tragedy happens to him. Listen though, before I go any further, heads up, if you're listening to this now, want to see this movie, do not watch the trailer for this film, because the idiots that cut the trailer for this movie should
Insane.
Be fired because the major tragedy is right there. And it's stupid. So anyways, don't watch the trailer. So a major event happens in his life. They fast track the fact that what happens to a lot of boxers is they end up getting ripped off. They're living beyond their means because they're kids from the street, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody sent them to the Wharton School of Business.
No, everybody else is looking after their money.
Yeah, we're looking after their money. And we're doing air quotes when we say looking after their money. Mm. So he hits rock bottom. He's got a kid. He's got to try to look after the kid. He tries. Ends up in a, going to go back to boxing, and he ends up with the kindly corner man with the heart of gold. Rough around the edges, though.
Yeah.
Right? I wanted to like this movie because I just thought it looked good. He was good, but it was just a cliche fest.
Yeah, yeah. I think you and I both agree that he's great in an okay movie. It's like what we saw late last year with Julianne Moore and Still Alice and a couple other
Jennifer Aniston,
where the movies are good, okay, but the performances are great. He is superb in this. He did all his own boxing in this movie. And Antoine, apparently, I saw him on TV this morning. He said he worked him hard.
Yeah.
Shot all the boxing stuff in a couple weeks.
The boxing sequences are really impressive.
Yeah.
Really impressive.
But I saw this movie 40 years ago when it was called Rocky.
Yeah.
It's tough to reinvent that movie. People have done it. I think there's better boxing movies out there in the last 10 years. But this one, like Forrest Whitaker, could be replaced by Burgess Meredith. And the fact that you and I had, I'm not a big boxing fan. You covered it years ago, but I just found there were a lot of technical things that distracted me. You know, hey, we're fighting in 8 weeks, or how can you possibly go from that money to you are literally living on the streets? I know what
happened. Well, when your manager's 50 Cent, who apparently thinks it's okay to declare bankruptcy when you've only got $50 million left.
Yeah. No, it's just things, and you know, signing a $30 million, three fight deal with HBO, that doesn't, come on.
No, you get that for one fight if you're the champ. And actually, you get $150 million if you're the champ.
And you're gonna do the first fight in 8 weeks. You've just come out of a punishing fight. You're the champ. You can dictate when you want to do your stuff.
Yeah, I know. So. I don't understand why those mistakes were made. Like, because, you know, it's funny, too, with this right now. You have a boxing got a huge spike in interest because of the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, even though that was one of the worst fights I've ever
seen.
It was like, you and I might have just wrestled a little bit more entertaining. Well, that's for another time on a different channel.
I will be talking about that on the European version of this podcast.
The European version. It's like your in-flight movie, Dana and Jim Grapple. That's the name of your record. Grapple.
That was actually, yeah. It was just grappling.
Just grappling. So you would have thought that they would have had a little bit more of the technical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And we don't want to give away what the disaster, the tragedy was, but even the tragedy was, come on, man.
Yeah.
We can't get into the things that they ignored.
And they got so glossed over.
Yeah.
So I'm going with this as a way to go to Jake Gyllenhaal, but a resounding average for me for this one. If you just want a movie, like this is a Netflix movie, VOD movie, if you're in on a rainy day maybe, but I in good conscience don't tell you to go spend $15 to go to the theater for it.
I should have looked this up before we came on, but again, boxing movies, there was one that you and I both liked, I think 2 years ago, with a fairly unknown, from Mad Max, Tom Hardy?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
Tom Hardy and Joel Egerton, which I think was Brothers or something like that, which was really good.
This
movie is just tough to
reinvent.
Even
The Fighter, that was
The
good,
Fighter, right? But it's just tough to reinvent this kind of story because it's been done to death going back to like the 40s. So, Jake, good performance, average movie, 6 out of 10 for me.
6 out of 10. I'll go with you on that. Okay. 6 out of 10. So what are we suggesting this week at the end of It's All Said and Done? Irrational Man?
I'd say Irrational Man. I'd also say look for some of the stuff that we've given big thumbs up to over the last couple weeks. Might go to that, but we got some biggies coming next week.
Well, you can go and find out. You can go and look in our archives and listen to Jim and I talk all the time. If you go to your iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. What do you think, Adam? I'm getting really good at promoting this.
Can I ask you, what is Stitcher?
I don't know. What is Stitcher?
What is Stitcher, Adam?
I think Adam's just making me say that out loud just because it's funny.
Don't say anything.
Next week, we'd like you to download your podcast from the High Diddle Day site.
Yeah, the McLaren screwdriver and everything else, yes.
A Rusty. Who was it yesterday that ordered a Ryan soda?
Got a big thumbs up to City TV, our good friend Thor Dykow.
Yeah.
We were sitting in a bar before the Sandler movie. I order a beer. Another critic orders a beer. We get to Thor and he orders Ryan water. She said, were you and Humphrey Bogart going out after the film?
They're going out there.
She said, Thor's a great guy. We love him. But I said, wow, well done. That's so old-fashioned.
He had the afternoon free from the assisted living home he's been at. Okay, well, Jim, thanks a lot. And
thanks,
we'll check in with you next week.
Thanks to Adam.
Thanks to Adam. Yay. Adam and his shirt.
Adam's got great shirts. Folks, you got to see these shirts.
I wouldn't go that far. Okay, that's it for this episode of the DGP with me, Dana G. Before I go, I'd like to thank Adam Foster, who sits here in the dark with me, Carol Pope, Trixie Mattel, and CTV's Jim Gordon. Now, if you can, please download the show next week and check out my interview with one-time super agent Stevie Phillips. Her memoir, Judy, Liza, Robert, Freddie, David, Sue, and Me, while sporting a cumbersome title, is a fantastic page-turner. I read the book and I kept thinking, who knew there was still somebody still alive who could tell us firsthand some more crazy Judy Garland stories. Like, I'm telling you, the Judy Garland stories are wild. Phillips' book, while it opens with Judy and shines a light on other interesting relationships, it's not just a read for lovers of Hollywood stories, but it also has a kind of an insightful, caring look at addiction. Also on the July 31st episode, Jim Gordon and I will review the new movies Mission Impossible. It's the fifth outing for Mission Impossible. Also The Gift and a great documentary called The Best of Enemies. So check us out at theprovince.com/podcasts or on Stitcher, iTunes, and TuneIn. Also follow The Province Podcast on Periscope and watch the show live as we record it here in the studio. Thanks for listening, and as usual, keep it real.
You've been listening to the DGP, hosted by province writer Dana G. Follow Dana on Twitter at Dana_G or read her stories on theprovince.com. Subscribe to this and other great province podcasts by searching iTunes or clicking the links available on theprovincepodcasts.com.